to this week's episode of Get the Fork Out. We have fellow yacht chef, the Galley Man, on this week's episode, and we're going to hear his story. We're going to hear how he got started cooking, maybe some tales of woe from his experience in hardcore kitchens, and then how he found out about yachting, and there's probably tales of woe from his first shitty boats that we all start on. The Galley Man, welcome. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good, bro. I'm good. It's a pleasure to finally be on here with you and chew the fat. So yeah, looking forward to it, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad to have you on. It's you're one of those characters that I see on the gram, and I'm like, I bet he's got some stories. Let's hear him. Let's hear him.
Oh, I'll try and give the listeners what they want, for sure. Brilliant.
Well, you decided to become a chef when? What inspired you? How old were you? What kicked it all off?
I think my story is pretty simple in terms of where it all started. You know, it's kind of definitely the cliche comment from a lot of chefs, you know, playing around with food when you're young, helping your mum or, you know, your guardians kind of cooking the kitchen at home, you know, baking cakes and things like that. So that's definitely where, for me, it really kind of started, and I took a shining to eating. I think is the most important thing that we must stress here, is that I love to eat. Even if it's shit food, if it's, you know, mediocre food, or, you know, the world's best food, I love to eat. You know, that just that little moment to yourself where you're just, you know, getting in there, getting involved, being interested with different flavors and stuff like that. So that's kind of where it was all born. My sister and myself used to cook on Sunday afternoons, you know, making a cake together or whatever. But my mum would always, on a Sunday, she'd always prepare this kind of salad buffet, you know, and it would be anything from peeled sticks of celery to whole cherry tomatoes to a chiffonade of iceberg to a platter of ham and leftover roast meats and all that, you know, jazz. And I can distinctly remember that I would try and make, I must have been like 5 or 6 here, or 7 or 8.
Wow.
That I would always try and make a face out of all the ingredients on my plate. And I would take pictures of it. You know, I'd get like the salad cream and try and make it into a smiley face or teeth or hair or whatever. And I think that's where the imagination of putting something onto a plate that looked like a picture, obviously no correlation to the level of what, you know, we all aspire to achieve and the great chefs out there. You know, it was definitely not refined or pretty or clean lines or anything like that. But it was just, for me, it was just the joy of trying to create a plate of food.
It sounds like you were encouraged to play with your food, unlike the rest of us that was shunned. That's good. That's interesting.
Yeah, I grew up in a house that was very much meat and two veg, you know, and a treat once a week. This is what, obviously, before I got my paper round and all that stuff, and then found McDonald's and all those bastardizations of food.
The American cancer.
The American cancer, you know. But that's, you know, we'll come to that probably, I guess, in a bit. But for me, it was definitely, you know, meat, potatoes or a starch and veg, you know, and looking back, massively overcooked, you know, in terms of carrots and things like that. But we've all been there.
That was the time. That was the era where it was, I don't know if they were afraid of crispy vegetables or what, but they cooked the shit out of them.
It was, you know, you just put it on your fork and it almost wanted to run away because it was just so embarrassing. But, you know, we live in
all
we
the
live
same
alone.
Color.
Exactly. It's kind of limp kind of broccoli on your fork. And, you know, I can understand why kids didn't really want to eat their veg at that kind of era. But I soldiered on for all of us, so we did well there. And I guess from that kind of bit of fun in you know in the family kitchen, I kind of went to school and, you know, did all my usual classes. And then we got to that stage where in the UK where you can choose, I think it's 3 or 4 extra classes.
Yes.
And from that, I decided to do food technology, which the year before was called home economics.
Yeah, so food same titles in the US.
Yeah, it was supposed to be this kind of more scientific approach to food. Was it bollocks? It was just the same, you know, modules and everything. And I really kind of thrived in that. You know, I was kind of always intrigued to know more. I was always wanting to understand why, if I took the cake out too early, why did it sink? Or, you know, if I cooked it at the wrong temperature, why did it go black and it was still raw in the middle? So, you know, I'm young, I'm a kid still. So I'm still, you know, wanting to work out why it doesn't look like the ones in a shop. What's the difference between cooking in a classroom and going to the corner shop and getting, you know, a cake there that looks perfectly perfect and tastes perfect to my young palate? Why can't I replicate that? And it wasn't like an obsession, but it was always in the back of my mind as to what the element and what the craft was going into it and how these mass things were made, as well as, you know, going to the bakery down the road and so forth. So
let,
I think,
let me interrupt you real quick for 1 second. Yeah, of course. I want to have a point. Like it was the same for me with home ec, or we call it something else, but same. I was like, it's crazy when you tell your story, it's very similar to mine. But I think when you're learning food that young, there's an element of common sense you don't have. You just don't have
100%.
It. And so to learn through food is quite intense. But go ahead. That's all I want to say.
No, that's a brilliant standpoint to add in for sure. And then, I think just, you know, went through school life and, you know, going out and with my mates and, you know, those kind of, I think we had restaurants like Wendy's, Wimpy. So that's, you know, the introduction to the Americanization of, you know, a young palate. So burgers with your mates, you know, go swimming and then the chip shop, all those kind of things. And I kind of, I kind of realized that I was interested in it. You know, obviously I had aspirations to be a pilot, a football, soccer player, you know, celebrity, all that things that you harbor when you're young. You want to be this big shot. You want to be successful, rich, drive fancy cars and all that stuff. But I had an innate want to create. And I think food was that kind of, not calling, but there was that defined interest in it. So I left school, went to catering college, did the whole, you know, classes, you know, I think it was 5 days, four or five days a week, did all that. And I remember, here's the first funny story. So first day of class, we had this old guy called Mike Jervis. Now he'd had a Michelin star restaurant, knew the who's who of the UK restaurant scene. So he knew Gordon Ramsay, and he would quite happily tell us Brian Turner. So he'd throw out all these big names in, you know, the first few classes that we had. And he would tell us about, you know, his Ferrari. We got to saw his Ferrari in the car park. And, you know, this is what you can achieve with hard work and all this stuff. I'm like, but we're going to be chefs. Chefs don't all have Ferraris. But anyway, let's, you know, we'll live the dream. We'll go with the dream. Anyway, so one day we're all in the class and he got a phone call and he had to dash out. So me being the prankster that I am, kind of cottoned on with the other kid in the class that was also a bit of a prankster. So I kind of took the lead, shall we say, a little bit here. And I was like, right, okay, guys, we will need to fill up the sinks ready for when, you know, when chef comes back in, because I'm sure he's probably going to ask us to, you know, have all the sinks full of water and ready to go. So there was this kid called Simon that was maybe not the smartest, you know, cookie in the packet. And I remember getting a whisk and walking over to him and say, oh, yeah, just before chef went, he said that you needed to stand there and whisk the water up till it goes really thick. And no word of a lie, this guy picked the whisk, took it off me and started whisking his water. And it was just the funniest thing, because he was sweating and really going for, you know, me and I think it was Gary, the other kind of class idiot, shall we say, you know, really encouraging him to, you know, whisk faster and faster. And then obviously, the chef came back in and he was like, yeah, chef came back in and went, which prat, you know, has been telling Simon to whisk water, and kind of everybody just sheepishly looked over at me, Gary. So that didn't go down so well, but. You know,
it didn't.
That's what
you don't think it gave chef respect a little bit at all.
I think inside he probably was probably rolling over in fits of laughter, but I think in front of everybody else he kind of had
outwardly
stern face. But my relationship with him was great. I learned a lot. You know, we're talking very, very basic, you know, getting ready for your kind of first job, you know, boiling an egg, you know, all the cuts of vegetables and the navrin of lamb and the, you know, doing the perfect jacket potato and then working in the canteen at college and all that, you know, stuff, which isn't enough. It's not enough to...
I agree. I did the same.
Get chefs into proper kitchens. It's just not enough. It's not. I'll get onto this in a minute. I had a, you know, massive baptism of fire when I started my professional, you know, career. I went from West Thames College, and my first job was the Waterside Inn. So, you know, three Michelin star kitchen, with the famous, you know, Michel Roux and all the guys down there in Bray. So the story behind that was Gary, as I forementioned, his dad was, I think, one of the directors for a company called Gate Gourmet that does all the food for airlines in London. So it looks after Gatwick, Heathrow, Stansted. And his father was an ex-pastry chef and was kind of in the melee of all that kind of huge operation. And Gary would always tell me that my dad knows Gary Rose and blah, 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 blah. So he was like, I'm going to get a job working here and working there. Gary now is a mechanic, just so everybody gets the backdrop of kind of Gary's intent, reminding me that he could work anywhere in the world, is now a mechanic. Nothing wrong with being a mechanic.
Nothing wrong with a mechanic at all.
But obviously we all have our own little journeys and where life takes us. So anyway, he was forever going on about this. And one day we got the bus back to our homes. He lived literally 10 minutes walk from my house. And I walked into the corner shop and picked up the famous Caterer magazine. I'm not sure if that branched internationally, but it was quite a big thing in the UK. So a lot of your subscribers that are English will probably definitely know of this catering magazine.
I'm sure.
So you'd go in, you'd open this magazine, it would have the latest Brat Pan, the latest Rationale, the latest chef, you know, and all that jazz. But it also had a feature on this particular one of the 10 most influential chefs of that era. And the first one was Michel Roux at the Waterside. And I remember kind of walking into my house, kind of half reading it. And my dad was like, oh, what are you reading? I was like, oh, this is Caterer magazine. He's like, oh, let's have a look. So he had a little look through. I said, yeah, I'm really intrigued by this old guy. You know, he seems like he's kind of like everybody talks about him. So all the younger chefs, now when I say younger chefs, I'm talking about the Pierre Whites, the Ramses, the Rhodes, you know, Novellis, those kind of guys were all talking about him. It's been influential for them, for the whole industry as a whole in the UK. And I was like, I'd love to work for someone like that. And my dad just turned around to me and went, well, why don't you write? And I was like, shut up, Dad. I'm literally, you know, just about to finish college. There's absolutely no way they're going to take a little idiot like me that knows absolutely nothing. You know, I didn't even have proper chef's shoes. I used to wear a pair of kickers boots and those old checkered blue and white chef pants, you know, that were massively way too big for you. But it like bloody wearing kite. Oh, absolutely awful. I mean, just absolutely awful. So anyway, so I wrote this letter and I was about to post it. My dad said, well, let's, you know, it's not too far from home. We'll go in the car. So we drove there. And little did we know that it was the winter closing, so they were obviously closed. So I was like, oh, a bit deflated, because then I kind of pumped myself up. My dad had kind of got me to a level to believe that I could, you know, work in the three Michelin star straight off the bat of college. So anyway, we pushed it through the office door, which obviously was shut. Maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks passed, didn't hear anything. And I remember coming back from college and my dad said, oh, there's a letter here from you. I think it's from that restaurant in Bray. So I'm like, I'll have a look at that later. Where's the PlayStation? Blah, blah, blah. He says, no, you should, come on, you should open it. And I was thinking, well, yeah, it's just going to be like, thanks very much. You know, here's a signed, I don't know, menu or something. And we wish you the best of luck with your career. But in fact, it was actually to offer me to go down for the day and spend the day with them, which I did. Absolutely shitting myself, petrified.
I'm sure.
Took my little bag of Global knives, which, you know, everybody told you they were the best knives to get back there. Nothing wrong with Globals. Nothing wrong with Globals. Just not for me. They ripped my hands to bits. Not a fan of them, I'm afraid. So went for the day, met the great Mark Dogson, who was a chef at the time, that had gone through the ranks. So he had joined as a chef de partie and become the head chef there. And I just remember this intimidating, intense, but yet loving environment. Just so many people just so focused on one goal of sending out a plate of food that was just gonna transform someone's lunch, day, or evening. And I remember just the smells and the sounds and the clatter and the buzz, because everything was predominantly said in French. So, you know, all the orders were said in French. So I had to very carefully and quickly kind of grasp what was going on. Yes, I was only there for a day, but I was asked to go and get this from that section and pass it to that section and stuff like that. So it was all kind of... absolutely. You know, watching the clogs all just work so well. And so it was almost like watching a ballet performance, you know.
Yeah, a dance. It's referred to that a lot.
Yeah. You know, just controlled aggression, controlled precision, controlled. I mean, there's other kitchens that I've worked in that aren't or haven't been as calm, shall we say. But this was great. So anyway, I spent the day and I got called into the office at the end. And I was sat there talking to the chef. And I just had this massive waft of this, for want of a better word, just this class, just this French waft of I don't know, inspiration. And it was Mr. Roux coming in, smelling of Cartier and that, and it was just this big booming deep voice of, oh, hello chef, how are you, kind of, you know, in a French English kind of twang thing going on. And I turned around and I nearly slid off the chair because it was the great Michel Roux. It was like, you know, how did you enjoy your day, blah blah blah. And the chef was like, yeah, I was just talking to P, and I was actually just going to come to the point of whether we would actually like to work here. And I was kind of like, you know, and I was like, yes, I'd love to. And then they were both like, well, you don't know what the salary is yet. And I was like, I don't care. I want to learn. I want to become the best I can be. So he basically from that said, okay, well, I'd like you to make me a salad. So I went and made a salad, you know, being all energetic and happy. So I remember getting this lovely, beautiful Heirloom tomato and, you know, taking the green off the end, slicing it nicely with my razor sharp Globals that I'd spent probably all week before, you know, trying to sharpen that were probably as blunt as a pencil. Fanning it all out and printing it on a lovely glass plate. For a salad, it looked beautiful.
Yeah.
Little did I know that I was about to get my pants literally pulled down in the nicest possible way. So, you know, Mr. Roux called me over. He was like, look, the presentation of your salad is great. However, this is wrong. This is what you would get at a good, you know, pub. We're, you know, 10 levels above that. So, and I was like, okay, I'm really sorry. He's like, you don't need to be sorry. You didn't know. You know, we wanted to see where you were at. And he explained, you know, de-seeding the tomato, taking the skin off, you know, maybe putting the tomato as a concass, you know, maybe a dressing and, you know, tasting and not over dressing a salad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those first words are still the mantras I live to today when I cook. So even if I get asked to make a Caesar salad, you'll never see me pour the dressing straight over the leaves. I will put the dressing to the side of the bowl, and as I'm bringing around the salad, it's been coated. Now, any chef, you know, that understands and respects their ingredients probably will know this story and probably be rolling their eyes. But for those that maybe don't, it's a good marker to understand that, you know, being gentle with it actually has a great ending when you come to eat it, because it's not claggy, it's light, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I went home after that, got the job, and I think I started maybe a couple of months later. So the funny story.
How old were you?
I was 17, about to go on to 18. So I spent just over two years there, got a little copper pan, which is somewhere, I'm in my new house.
Amazing.
I've been with my fiance in the UK. So it's being decorated and stuff like that. So it's probably somewhere, which I'll put it up, because it's something that's very close to me, very close to my heart. And you know, it's a good reminder when I see it of the kind of where the story kind of started. So my first salary. For sure. Absolutely. I'm immensely proud of that time. Not the original salary that I had, which I think was about $8,000 with service on top. And I was, you know, doing over 120 hours a week. Yeah, yep. Not going to get a Ferrari out of that, are you? But
no.
The teaching and what it brought was, you know, I met some fantastic chefs, lifelong friends. I cooked for some amazing clients, met some amazing people. We had this old family, Mr. and Mrs. that were maybe 70 and 80, that had saved up for like 5 years just so they could come and eat at the waterside. He promised that he would take his wife to the waterside. Yeah, so it's, you know, you have millionaires and billionaires that come and, you know, want turbot and, you know, Pont Neuf, you know, and tartar sauce, and, you know, we'll charge them £90, you know. And then you have the other extreme where you have someone that's been saving up for years to come. And so that attention to detail, because you don't know who you're cooking for. You know, you could be cooking for kings and queens, and you'd be cooking for, you know, a young guy that wants to impress a girl that's been saving up all year because, you know, he wants to, you know, wants to bag the woman of his dreams. So,
equal attention.
Amazing. Really. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the things I learned from there. Various stages, I went and worked for Tom Atkins, which was yin and yang in terms of the kitchen ethos. Yeah, I mean, I've to this day not been in the kitchen where I've seen a chef as all over it as he was. He would know I've told this story to a few of my close friends, but he would know what was going on in the fridge around the corner. He would know if you were pissing around, if you were trying to take a brief through and shit. He would know whilst he would be cooking and running the pass. Literally. But he was also an arsehole. You know, he would grab people by the scruff of the neck. He would throw, if he saw one bit of dice that was irregular to the rest of the pot, he would throw the pot back. And obviously, working in London at that time, you were getting in at 7 and you weren't leaving till sometimes 1 o'clock. So your prep was almost like your family. You know, if someone was about to throw a pot of your, I don't know, puree back, you didn't want that to hit the floor. You wanted to catch it because it was what you'd been spending all day, not probably had lunch, you know, not seen outside, had fresh air for 12 plus hours. So you'd see chefs trying to catch these red hot pans. You'd see chefs whipping them. The sous chef would be right on your ear, you know, shouting abuse and stuff like that. And that was just kind of London back then. Now you just couldn't do that. Chefs would just walk out, and there's obviously already a shortage of chefs in the industry as a whole. You just couldn't do that. And I think I was probably, our age was probably the last era that would kind of put up with it. I mean, I've had racism in the kitchen. I've been called this and that. I won't go into the exact words, but I've had it. Back then it was, you know, not to jump on the whole racism thing and stuff like that, but back then it was
talk about it if you want.
Almost acceptable. You know, it was almost acceptable to do and say things like that. I mean, I got terrorized a little bit by a little French guy that would call me cochon noir, which obviously translates to black pig. Just because he thought he was in that kind of cool French boys, you know, they all stank anyway, so I didn't really want to be that close to them. But you know, the saucière, so there's obviously a saucière in a French Michelin star kitchen is very important. You know, it's kind of
it's a very prestigious position to
probably work up the to hardest. Yes, exactly. Yeah, probably the hardest position. But if once you can master it, you know, you are seen as somewhat of a kind of a hero because you're consistent with your sources.
No one even knows what this guy does. It's just magic.
Yeah, it's sorcery. You recipes. Like, is your name Harry Potter? and I kind of just would just blank it out, really. And then I used to get terrorized by a chef called Sarah. She ended up marrying the saucier. They had a one Michelin star gastropub down in the south of the UK. Phenomenal chef she was, both of them, but she used to terrorize me, and not bully, but she would very early on, as I would gather later on looking back, she was teaching me attention to detail. So there we'd get these big boxes of spinach in, we had to wash them 4 or 5 times. And, you know, when you're doing 3 or 4 of these in the morning is your first job, it gets a bit tedious. So you try and cut corners and stuff like that. And I remember one service, she was about to put we were doing this lobster dish and there was, you know, wilted spinach with it. And I remember she literally dragged me from the corner where I was doing souffles. And she was like, have you seen the fucking state of this spinach? If I serve this spinach, I'm getting fired, you're getting fired, and probably the whole of the section is getting fired. And that was kind of those kind of moments that kind of instill
those lessons.
You know, that it all starts, you know, the tedious jobs end up to the beautiful precision that goes on the plate at the end. And if there's one stage of that that's missing, then it just doesn't work, you know.
So, no, it's unimportant. It's all hyper-valuable. And it's hard to quantify that as a young person, as a young chef, where you're like, oh, I'm doing the worst jobs, this is such bullshit. But you don't have the capacity to see the big picture yet. You don't have the capacity to see that what you're preparing is going to enter a diner's mouth and they're paying a shitload of money.
You know? Yeah, like, exactly.
It's going to happen. It better be good, man. It's got to be perfect.
Absolutely. I think, and then from there, you know, I went and worked other restaurants, but that's the most impressionable restaurant experience that I've ever had. You know, I've done stages at Jason Atherton's restaurants. I've done stages in Norway, in France, in Scotland, and in London as well, and San Francisco. All amazing, you know. But that first impression, those first smells, that first romance, you know, of working in a Michelin star kitchen at 3 stars, and you know, even to the stupid things of cleaning the stoves at the end of the night when the ceramic tops were still absolutely boiling hot and going through pairs of Birkenstocks because you wanted to get home because you were that tired that you were eating into your time, you know. And I think that's why you have certain chefs in our industry, if we flip quite a fast forward to yachting, that are very very quick to get cleaned down and very quick to, because they have, you know, I don't want to be in the kitchen, as much as I love what I do, I don't want to be in the kitchen 35 minutes, 40 minutes after I've sent desserts. I want to be in the crew mess or in my cabin, asleep, sending those emails that I haven't sent, or, you know, in, you know, editing or menu design or whatever.
Sending order, all that shit, it just adds up.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people don't grasp that. Yeah, absolutely. So from the restaurant scene, I then went and worked
for a chain.
Yeah, sorry.
Just real quick on your, that's such a cool experience you had at the Waterside, right? The three Michelin star.
Yeah.
Michelle Rue. I just think, like, for a formative experience at 17 going on 18, that's real special. Like, you've got some really good habits, like, burnt in from the start. Like, they're just
going there.
I think it's really cool, man. I think I really like your dad, too. I think he did a kind of a clever thing to encourage you.
Absolutely. Even though
without his kind of gentle prodding, who knows?
You know, absolutely.
You would have worked out no matter what, but, like, you got that dream job because you did something different than everyone else.
Yeah, but I mean, I also used to go home various times and cry because I fucked up as well.
Yeah.
I'm not ashamed to admit that, you know, that I would send, you know, something that I may have not done or done enough of would send the whole kitchen into the shit. It's not a nice feeling. It's not, you know, it's the worst. I don't understand the
amount of pressure that even the young cooks are under. It's not just the head chef. It's like the amount of pressure, and it's either getting screamed out or, as you said, letting the whole team down.
Yeah,
it is. I remember being in the walk-in at like 20 years old, just like gagging, like because it was gonna be a 350 cover Saturday night at the best restaurant in Boston. We'd have two turns on every table, three turns on some tables, plus bathroom downstairs, and I'd be like, "Holy shit! I hope I'm ready." And just be like alone, just gagging in the lock-in. Like, as a kid.
Like, exactly. I mean, now it's like I've learned the lessons the hard way. So like when I have a sous chef that is maybe panicking about something, I'm like, it's gonna pass. So
yeah.
For a defined, especially in yachting, you know, we're very regimented in terms of how long our services last. It's not like we start at 5:30 and we're getting absolutely smashed until 11 o'clock at night. We know that maybe it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and then by 10 o'clock we're done. You know, we should be lights off, out, pull your other stuff for the next day or whatever. So I try and tell my sous chefs that it's only for a short amount of time. So, you know, if you fuck up, you're not necessarily going to lose your job if it's once. If it's consistent, then yes, you know, like me, like you. But don't overwork, don't overthink something. There's always a solution to a problem. Yeah. And half the time, the guests won't even know that there's a problem.
I think some of the, to be a yacht chef means you've got to recover not just from your mistakes, but guest changes and last minute and everything. It's like, and there's only like two or four of you back there or the sole chef warriors, and you just have to pull it out of your ass. You just have to make it work. And like, I feel like the longer you do this job, the more tricks you have up your sleeve. You don't even know they're up there until something happens. You're like, damn. Got this. Don't worry. I put this in the freezer a month ago for this very reason, and boom, there we go.
It's exactly. I think a lot of it is you've got to be able to, and some people might disagree with this, and to be quite honest, I couldn't really care.
We're all
bullshitting because we're all trying to, the minute that the old saying, where a chef wakes up, he's in the shit. That is true. You are in the shit because you need to get your jobs done so that you're not in the shit. So if I get asked in the middle of service, can you do this? Now, if I've got the mise en place for it, no problem. If I haven't got the mise en place for it, then I'm going to rely on that experience to try and get that same product out as quick as I can. But I'm not going to lose my shit. Going back to when I was at the Waterside and just coming out of that period, would I have lost my shit? Absolutely.
You wouldn't have had any of that knowledge.
Yeah, but there's no need to. It's all about, for me, a calm presence in front of my number two, in front of Chief Stew, in front of the service girls, and my fellow crewmates. We all live together. They don't want to, in my opinion, they don't want to be living with someone that is a rant and a raver. Don't get me wrong, I've had my moments. I've had my moments where I fought cat and dogs with Chief Stews in the past. The one I currently work with, we're almost like brother and sister.
That's awesome.
We know how to speak to each other. I know how to part mentalize. If something else has pissed me off and they're asking me a question, I know now to go, can you just give me 2 minutes? You know, instead of taking what else is pissing me off and pushing it onto someone else. We don't know what's going on in that other person's life, you know?
Right.
It could be
with the guests right outside.
Exactly. You know, and half the time, the guests are even pissed, not at the table anyway. Mm-hmm. And there's a big passage of time between when that plate leaves the galley to it being put down in front of the client. That they wouldn't even. So sometimes it's about slowing everything down.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. There's a delay. It's it's awful. but yeah, there's also a gap of time that I realized too. Is like when the plate gets put down, the guest may or may not even like be available to eat it. You know, like you've waited. Okay, go, and it's like. Man, it's difficult on a yacht. I want to get back to your story too about like how you started in yachting, but just like one more point. It's like difficult on yacht compared to any sort of restaurant, because like if you go to a restaurant, that's kind of your focus. You're just gonna eat there. Or in a yacht, it's like, I'm gonna go for a paddleboard or I'm gonna go for a shower, and it's like herding cats a lot of times. So I mean, I would love the percentage of like hot food to enter people's mouths and cold, like the percentage is low. Like it doesn't, and it's not even because we're not trying. 100%. It's just circumstances of distraction with these people. But
I think that's the, like speaking to other chefs, you know, going through the passage of where I've got to now in the industry, it's always been, you know, fucking the plates will be fucking cold by the time they go get to the table and all that stuff. You can only control what you put on the plate. So the other stuff, I mean, I remember I used to plate up and I used to run in front of the girls and stand up in the pantry and watch every single plate go out.
Yeah.
Just all I'm doing to myself is just stressing myself out, you know, and then having to go back and then clean down and then start again. There was just no point. It's a level of trust as well. You know, I trust the team that I work with now impeccably, that everything goes out perfectly how I would like it to, you know. There's no squabbling over plates and stuff like that. If the girls have done a beautiful, you know, table, you know, decoration, and they would like to use black plates, then I'll make my food work on black plates, you know?
Yep.
It's a team effort. I think, you know, I hear these horror stories of, you know, both sides, arrogancy from both sides, and it's not productive. It's counterproductive. So that's all I want to say on that bit.
All right. How'd you hear? So we never heard of you went from nice restaurants, banging restaurants, Michelin stars to like, and what was some of your boats? What was your first boats?
So I first worked on a boat called Landes with a, how do I phrase this in the politest? I really want to say the C word, but I probably shouldn't. Head chef. Now she was female. I'm only telling you that because she was female. That's not a dig at any female chefs, just to put it out there. She had this innate need and want to tell me about previous sous chefs, like every single day. Oh, my former sous chef Vicky would do it like this, and she'd be done by now, and all this stuff. So it was my first boat. She knew I'd come from Michelin star, you know, background and restaurant background and private houses and all that kind of jazz. I wasn't allowed to use on a trip, I wasn't allowed to use the ovens or the hob space until the end of breakfast service, which could be 10:30 and 11:30. All my mise en place had to be, so if I was making a Caesar salad, think of a large Ziploc bag. So 17 crew. I would have my eggs at the bottom, my croutons, my peeled or shaved parmesan, my dressing would be in a Ziploc bag, and my salad would be prepped, and it would all be in this one big Ziploc bag because I wasn't allowed to use any bowls. There was more than enough bowls for her and me to use, but there was just this pedantic, slightly, not slightly, this controlling
very territorial way. I'd say
yes, and
she was rubbing her musk on certain things. Don't use that, that's fine.
Yeah, 100%, you know. Yeah, it was like, it's mine, and it was kind of like just very difficult to work in it. You know, she knew more information than the captain. She was kind of like, you know, the big cheese on board.
Wait, she actually knew more information or per perception?
Yeah, because she weaseled her way into the boss's wife, so she would find out about when the trips were coming, you know, and she would suggest to the captain about this anchorage, and I was talking to such and such last night, and they were talking about going here. So one of those old school, you know, chefs, you know, that had kind of become the beast in the industry. I know this, you know, recruiter, you know, that's hardcore and all this stuff. I won't name names, but I'm sure that you could probably
you do see that in the older versions of some of these personalities, as it's all about the past and who they knew. And
yeah, it's just, it's like, well, times have moved on, you know. And
yeah.
So yeah, I worked with her, and I remember one time I cut some lemon wedges, and I got something like, "You're a Michelin star trained chef, you don't have to cut a fucking lemon wedge." Well, I do, but you didn't tell me how you wanted your lemon wedges cut for your dish. I can only do, you know, if you want me to, exactly, if you want me to peel all the grapes, I'll peel all the grapes for you, it's not a problem. But I need to know the information of what you want from me so that I can do it. And it was always like that. It was always, you know, you didn't put the bread on in the bread machine. And I'm like, using a bread machine? And then it would be like, oh, there was one crumb of, you know, I clean the floor, I get on the floor and wipe it with my, you know, scrub it with my hands and knees. And she'd come in the morning and there would be nothing on there, mate. Nothing. But she would just say, oh, I was up here just after you finished and I came up again to clean the floor because there was two crumbs on the floor. And I'm like, two crumbs, mate, chill out. You know, but yet you go to the dry store and there'd be like 20 bottles of ketchup or, you know, five things out of date that are older than the boat and things like that. And it was, you can't use those. I'm going to need them for a trip. What the 4-day trip that we've got, you know, just that over kind of panicking and controlling nature, which wasn't helpful. I learned a lot. Don't get me wrong. But
how long did you
last? I was on there for 2 years. I think so. Whether that was stupidity or maybe I didn't think that I could, you know, progress, because I'd say it's maybe a little bit, the industry is a lot more open than it was when I started. So I've been yachting now, what, 8 years? I think back then it was definitely you had to know someone first to get that, you know, you had to know someone that was on a boat, you know, so you could get a job, or you had to have the right opening with a recruitment company or something like that. But I think now it's a lot more, I wouldn't say easier.
because my perspective is a tiny bit, a little bit longer, but I think maybe okay. that's what we all go through when we get to the industry, where it's hard to find a job. It's hard to even get to know people, to get to know the right people, where I'm not disagreeing with you, but it could be your perspective is different because you're a little more of a veteran now and have a name for yourself, and it's easier to find jobs.
Yeah, that's a very fair comment.
But you also might be right, as in the industry has exploded in the last 8 years. There's just not 100%. Enough crew. So you might also be right. Oh.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of those ones that's just down the middle, isn't it? You know, I think we're both equally correct in its essence. I just think now there is a lot more avenues to be able to maybe shorten that time of getting your first job. There's a lot more courses, a lot more, you know, Instagram, especially for chefs, is a lot easier to get yourself out there. Obviously, people can see your food. Obviously, they can't taste your food, but you can definitely tell when I'm looking for sous chefs and things like that, or temp people, I can definitely tell if I want to interview that person just by going off food pictures. Is that the right fit? Do I want that kind of food to be cooked for the crew? Will the crew appreciate that kind of food? You know, and I don't necessarily always look at food pictures. I look at the other pictures, you know, what do they do in there? What are they interested in? You know, do they go hiking, do they you know, eat out, you know, various other things, because you want to try and get a general kind of picture of what they would be like.
Good human. And it's absolutely hard to, I think the stigmatism with restaurant chefs, I'm sure it still is that, oh, you know, we don't want to hire a crazy person or a drug addict, or, you know, kind of in the yachting industry's mind, we're all like that. And really, it's just like the 1% of the industry in restaurants, or 5%, whatever you want to call it, is kind of like that. But also those people don't win in that industry either. So in order to be good at being a restaurant chef, you can't be any of those things that the yachting industry is fearful of. Not at a good restaurant. You just can't. You won't win. But I do feel like there is that. But in a way, to your story, I'm glad you were there for 2 years, because you probably, through osmosis, just learned the industry better without all the pressure of being a head chef on your shoulders.
Oh, 100%.
And met provisioners and like all this other cool shit. Probably like a year would have been enough, and then a year underneath someone else. And then were you a sous chef again, or would you get a head chef job? What happened?
No, I got a head chef job after that. So I went and worked for the infamous Shark Fleet. So back then it was very renowned for people not lasting so long. So there was, in that fleet, there was Polaris, Kodo. Mr. Lee, you know, Mr. Lee. See, everybody knows.
I did a month charter. I was on Ecstasy, the boat. Every time I say that, everyone's got to do the dumb joke. Hey, you worked on Ecstasy. 86 meter fed chip. So we did him for a month, man. Mr. Lee, he was a funny, funny dude.
A very interesting dude. Very interesting. So, you know, picture Croatia, you know, this kind of like these floating boats, you know, Polaris, Kogo, Infinite Shades was the boat that I joined as a head chef on. Premier, Galeo Sherdo, and then another little chase boat that would go and get provisions and stuff like that. And I joined, and I remember the first night we got to the anchorage, the boss was hankering to get on the boat, but the boat wasn't ready. But Polaris was doing this big, you know, welcome dinner and all that stuff, and I've been asked to do canapés. So all I know is, you know, have all your mise en place and everything ready. So off I go on a tender, go over, get on, go to the galley. And it's fucking, it's massive. Polaris is massive. It's got a pizza oven in there. You know, it's got fucking four full-size rationales in there. Everything, you know, it's literally the dream in terms of, you know, space set up for a galley operation. Downstairs, walk-in fridges that are probably the size of some interior boats. Just fantastic. And I remember going there, shitting myself because it was, you know, my first head chef job in the industry, but also going onto this absolutely prestigious boat. And they were kind of looking at me like, fucking hell, look at you with all your prep. And I was like, oh, shit, sorry. They were like, yeah, fucking, you know, because yes, they were ready, but they were, I think they weren't expecting, you know, I had, you know, all my things in piping bags with labels on. I had my croutons cut down to size. I literally had no prep to do. I was literally ready to do service. I kind of got the whole true picture of the shark fleet and all its interesting nooks and crannies and stuff like that. But that was, I guess, the awakening of the responsibility of, you know, running your own boat, so to speak, you know, ordering, and it never stops. There's always something, yeah, you know, which is, you know, I love it. It's what gives me a buzz. You know, I love it too. Kind of, you know, smashing out a, you know, dinner, and then, you know, cleaning down, and then going into my cabin, and then working on the next menu if I haven't already sent it off to the chief stew and so yeah, forth, and yeah, you know, the midway. I love it. You know,
yeah, maybe some of the deckies can go to the shore for me for like the guests ask for this, but I'm no way I'm gonna have time. And we're gonna be in St. Bart's or Saint Tropez, and they're like, ah, oh, there's a good veg market. They'll have this. And if they have this, grab that, the guests will be stoked. And
yeah, and exactly.
I think as all chefs, and I'm going to get called out on this, I'm sure, but like even especially as yacht chefs, all we do is solve problems. And that's why we're good at it, I guess. And that's why we love it, yeah, for sure. Is that every day is different. It's always dynamic. And you're either good at it and you enjoy it, or you hate it. You get the fuck out. Because that's what it is. Because it's never going to be, oh, provisions are going to come here then. No, they're not. We won't even be there. You're like, oh,
yeah, exactly. Right. You need to know how to put those fires out, but still having a smile on your face and getting the same standard of food out for sure. And I think, you know, I think that probably alludes very much into the sous chefs that are pushing to become head chefs, you know. Yeah. We've obviously privately spoken about an experience that I've just gone through a few months ago, yeah, where somebody felt that they were ready when perhaps they weren't ready, you know, attitude wise, cooking ability, you know, up there. But
cooking is the easy part.
Exactly that. And I think you have to be able to balance both of them, whilst the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth element of other things comes in. You know, when you're in the middle of the breakfast service sending out breakfast and the captain comes in and wants breakfast, or, you know, you get a call from the provisioner saying that your delivery is stuck in customs and, you know, other bits. And then, oh, they want to go ashore. Can you do a picnic? You know, while still trying to keep the same composure and consistency, these are the elements that I think a lot of the ones coming through don't necessarily grasp. And that's maybe, it might be age, it might be, you know, experience in cooking. I think some of them are a little bit blind to saying it, but then they get the whole, oh yeah, but I cook better than my head chef. And great if you cook better than your head chef, but can you run a galley better than your head chef? Because until you can do that, you're not ready to be a head chef. That's my opinion, and I might get gunned for that, but
how it is. I think it's easier. I'm not saying cooking for the crew is easy, especially these days with all the allergies and food preferences and all that shit. But it is, and it's also monotonous, but that monotony gives you kind of some protection in terms of you're going to work these hours these days, even when there's guests on board. And then hopefully in the right scenario, you're going to help the head chef put out fires, because that's all that dude or dudette is going to do all day.
It's just put dude, guest I love
fire
it.
after guest fire after guest fire. And they're guests. They could do whatever they want, you know? Like, this is the part that we have to deal with. And that also is the fun part of the job. But I think it's easier for a sous chef to be like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, can you have all these plates in the air? That's a thing. It's a lot different.
And without becoming rude and short and you know, aggressive and cocky and backstabbing.
I mean, sous chef, chief stew, and provisioner and captain. I mean, fuck, throw the chief engineer and chief officer in there too. Like, those are the backbone of a charter season. Like, you just any one of those things is off, you're like, ah, shit, come on. Oh,
exactly.
Man.
Yeah, you are in the shit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just a very interesting perception, because I love cooking for the crew, and I've had it in the past where I've said, I'll cook dinner for the crew. It's like, oh, no, that's my job. So I'm not taking your job. I'm not trying to, unless I'm having complaints about your crew food, then I will maybe do crew dinner to show you what can be done in the time, how clean you can work, and the standard that's required. I've done that on a few occasions, because sometimes certain people you talk to, or whatever, you just put some money in the meeting, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no. I can still hear. Don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. Just keep talking.
Maybe I'm fantastic. And I think I've literally almost lost my train of thought.
I don't know. We're
going on that.
You were talking about like cooking for crew just for the hell of it, which is fun.
Honestly, yeah,
like, it's not the same.
It's not. That's no.
Hell.
Oh well.
Oh well. We're almost at our hour anyway, but let's keep going, man. So, fantastic. All right. So, tell us, what was your first head chef job? As I look for some other source of light.
My first head chef job was Infinite Shades, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
And then what? Croatia, then what happened after Mr. Lee?
And then after Mr. Lee, he's
going to watch this.
after that, what did I do after that? It's a very good question. Ooh, I literally got, you know when you just get, you know you've done stuff, but you just can't remember what you've done.
Did you like freelance around for a bit?
No, I've never done freelancing in the yachting industry, weirdly.
No, I love it.
No,
I'll do like 4 years on a boat, and then I'll freelance around for like a year, maybe.
Oh, really?
Maybe during COVID, it was actually longer, just because like I want to sniff things out. You know, I don't want to commit. But once I'm somewhere and I'm happy, I'm like I'm stoked. I want to just stay there.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna move the camera where there's maybe a little more light.
I've worked on obviously Lunacy where I'm at now.
Yeah.
Worked on a boat called Soulmates, which was great. It was a great laugh, great owner, great captain.
Soulmates, is that?
Soulmates, yeah. It was a 55-meter Heesen.
Okay. Good boats. The Dutch.
Yeah.
Fan of the Dutch.
Yeah. Good boat. Small, too small for me. But my lifelong mate, Daryl, who's now the sous chef on that absolute beast of a boat. It'll come to me at some point. He's on 140 meter now. Great chef. Great guy as well. Like, you know, good friend to kind of, you know, go into battle with. But yeah, we used to have a captain that always used to come in all the time, and we'd just be chatting shit all the time. It's almost like just like a boy, almost like a boys' club, you know. Obviously, the deck is always quite clicky, but you know, there was me and Daryl, and there was a captain on Soulmates, and we would just chat absolute crap all day, cook great food for the crew and the guests, and just, you know, have a good old time, to be honest with you. It was a good crack. And then obviously I worked on Eternity, which is probably the boat that put my Without sounding like an arrogant dick, but it's probably where people maybe might have started to have heard of this little chef called Frosty or the Galley Man.
Frosty the Galley Man. Yeah, I should have linked those two names up in the beginning because people know you.
And that's kind of where, you know, I won the Antigua Yacht Show chef competition.
Hell yeah.
We just, you know, got into Forbes magazine and all that kind of stuff off the back of that, which was great. You know, I'm now trying to write a book, recipe book.
That's awesome.
As well.
So. Shit, yeah, man. More power to you. Yeah. I love these stories of, I just love chef stories in general because of the parallels to my life, and I can relate to perspective, experience, all that shit. Yeah. But I like the kind of the courageousness and like outside the box thinking of, yeah, I'm gonna write a book. Yeah.
I mean, you probably get it as well. I mean, through your social media channels, you probably get people that ask you, you know, for recipes or little advice. And I don't say this definitely not in an arrogant way, but I'm definitely someone that is, and what I like about our industry, whereas opposed to maybe the shore base, the Michelin star, is it can be quite secretive ashore. You know, if you want a recipe for something that's absolutely killer, if you're working in a restaurant, you've got to go and stage. Yeah, you've got to stage there, or you've got to have an inside.
Because I noticed that staging in London is like, and this is a few years ago. This is like, and I staged at L'Entrepide and Pied de Terre, and I noticed like because the Ledbury was kicking hard, and another restaurant just came out, but like, kind of there was a lot of similarities in terms of the dishes and stuff. Like a lot of the hits were being repeated. And so I do agree with you completely. Like I don't think in yachting it doesn't matter for shit, but on land you'd still be that old school, you know, French saucier that doesn't give out his recipes.
Yeah, and it's like it's absolute bollocks. I mean, if someone literally, you know, messages me and said, "Oh, can I have the recipe for?"
Yeah,
the twill.
You've given me recipes before. Yeah,
yeah, it's literally, you know, maybe if we're going for the same job, maybe I probably wouldn't, but. You know, no, but that's purely because obviously, you know, I've got things to pay for. It's not in a malicious way. It's just, I want to put my best foot forward. You wouldn't want to put your best foot forward. But
yeah, but even like, unless we're going for the same exact cooking interview, it wouldn't matter.
Exactly. Anyway. Yeah, exactly.
But what were you saying about like, basically that you're happy to share recipes? You know, you asked me if people hit me up for stuff. And what were you going to say about that?
I was just going to say, I just think that I love in general that the people that I've come across in this industry have always been more than happy to share, you know, like Josh, Nina, Mikhail,
Dean.
Dean have always been very, very happy to kind of, you know, share or, you know, and it's a two-way relationship, you know, it's not just, you know, taking and, you know, I'm very much, you know, happy to pass on anything that, you know, helps another chef. You know, doesn't necessarily have to be a recipe. It can be a hack or advice. Yeah. You know, or where to get from.
I've had it be a two way, but also a one way, and I'm happy to do the one way because it's people did it for me when I was getting into the industry when I was a young chef. And will I get that time back from that person? Will they have wisdom to exchange farther down? I hope so, but it's not that important. But most of the time it is like chefs and the back and forth. And I mean, not to get off topic, but I mean, I think 75-80% of the reason I do this podcast is for community. Like we talked about, it's not that secretive shit. It's like, well, we can all just be friends. We can all just share knowledge as a group and support each other rather than being like, nah, fuck you, I'm better. That guy's a piece of shit. Like there's none of that. There doesn't have to be. And if there is, I just walk away from it. I'm like, oh, whatever.
Some of the stuff I've seen, you know, because there's maybe some chefs that are very happy to share their thing. I share my food or the laughs and jokes, the bits of banter and stuff that you probably see on my stories or in my feed because A, I do it for myself, B, I take this job seriously, but I also don't take this job seriously. for me, I have to keep cooking fun. I have to keep cooking relatively relaxed for me to be able to put my best foot forward. Once it becomes stiff and stressful and chaotic and all heavy, for me, I don't enjoy what I'm doing.
Well, you hit on it in your story about walking into that three Michelin star kitchen for the first time, and it was serious, but there was some joking around. There was some, and that's what I love, that banter and that back and forth that we've had to, but we've been able to have access to our whole careers of just talking shit. While you do stuff that, is it serious? Yes. You need focus? Yes. Is it going to change the world? No. So we can have this back and forth, and you can make fun of me, I can make fun of you, and it's like, let's do it. Like, let's just fucking talk shit.
Exactly. So I listened to staying on that kind of topic. I listened to, if I'm allowed to talk about another social media outlet, I listened to something called The Nightcap, which is, I think the chef is Paul Foster, and another guy is a radio kind of DJ host. And they get other chefs on. So they get your Daniel Clifford's, your...
I'm writing this down.
You know, big chefs, you know, famous chefs. And they talk pretty much like, you know, we've been talking, and they just generally talk about funny stories, you know, how they come up with their dishes, how they run a Michelin-style kitchen and stuff like that. And I can often be found on a charter, you know, when my sushi's having a break and I'm getting ready for lunch service or dinner service, whatever, I'll have this on full boom. People, you know, deckies will come in and other stuff. Like, why are you listening to other chefs talking shit in a kitchen environment? But that's sole purpose, because it's talking shit. I can relate to them. I find it funny. You know, the little stories of, you know, how, you know, they dropped a plate, the service staff dropped a plate, or how after service, you know, you all went to the kebab shop. You know, just the little stories that kind of fill that void space sometimes when you're in a gallery on your own. You've got as company as a mixer and a, you know, and a thermomix that takes ages for the arms to go back onto the top of the disc.
Bro. Mate. I think it's slightly faster if you hit the dial as a button. I think it's, they open slightly faster that way.
Is it? Like, but it's still shit.
I would pay. I'd pay anyone that's listening to this $3,000 for the old TM. What was the first one? What was it for TM7?
With the dial.
Come on. Yeah. Like, stop. So these thermal mixes, I think the chefs, including the restaurant chefs, were like an ancillary benefit of their whole idea. They were making the shit for the happy housewife, and we just happened to realize, like, this bit of kitchen kit is almost, you can't not have it anymore. But they didn't make it for us. We're such a small niche, you know, like, they made it for the masses. So that's why we get the little arms that go,
brrr. Oh, mate. It's helpful that you've got the recipes on there, you know. I don't particularly use them, but I can see the benefit of them. But the old one, you used to be able to pick it up, shake it. You know, you'd
still have, do that, like, one,
that much
man.
That much puree in there, and you know you wanted it absolutely perfect, and you would shake it, avocados, and, you know, throw it around the whole kitchen and stuff like that. And
I toast my spices in there, and then then dust them up. So in order to do that, I gotta tilt it and then bang the corner of it. I need the blade to hit the corner, otherwise it doesn't work.
Like, brilliant. It's brilliant. It's an absolute, you know, brilliant bit of kit. I love it, you know. I love all the modern bits of equipment that we've got, but I also love the romance of just getting an absolute, you know, stunning rondelle, braising, you know, cooking the old-fashioned way, cartouche. So I like, you know, both elements of, you know, so we say an amalgamation of new and old.
Yes.
Bringing something new.
The old and the new.
Yeah.
I am a spoiled bitch. Like, I I love cooking in a yacht galley. I hate cooking in a home kitchen, where I look at what some other wonderful human in my life, probably friend or family, has bought they have access to a chef, but they did not ask for advice and they bought some trash. And then I'm supposed to like work twice as hard or something half as good. And I was like, oh, come on, guys. Like, just send me an email. I'll send you three options, three different yeah. price points of something good, something intelligent, something a chef would use. But I struggle with that. How about like ovens? I think that's the biggest thing. Like, yeah, of course, induction. But once you have a rationale, you're like, oh, God, you just look at it's basically like a weird hot box that just doesn't do shit. Like when I look at a normal oven, it's brutal, man. I don't know. Like I said, I'm a spoiled bitch.
So it's no. I mean, it's, you know, I'm obviously we're renovating the house here. We've got cats downstairs, and it's just it's like, oh, so I cook? No, I'll cook tonight. I just love gas.
Yeah.
Sleep it surely. The kitchen is almost going to be as well kitted out as a galley kitchen. You know, there's going to be a water bath and all that stuff. Because
excellent
for me, it's an extension. You know, when I'm on leave, I can try new
It's
quite interesting that you're talking about side of things, because if I go to my mum's, she's got little bits and pieces of like, he's still there.
Yeah, it's just it's been hit and miss the whole time. I checked the speed before we had it. It was like,
oh, okay,
but yeah, that whole it just dove out a little bit for a while. But yeah, so basically you were saying at some point we're gonna have to say goodbye because it keeps saying like it's unstable. But yeah, it's my internet here. I'm in the mountains. Well, I'm not. I'm just up north where it's flat, but I'm in the middle of nowhere. You still there?
Yeah, yeah, I'm still there.
All right. So what were you saying? Because I feel you. Like if I had a place at home, which I don't, I would like to have like a nice, relaxing, fun time of cooking rather than like frustrating.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's like, you know, open a bottle of wine, you know, make some dinner, you know, family over, friends over, but be able to kind of still not necessarily do all the fancy schmancy stuff that you do on a yacht, but still be able to, you know, do something. I just bought a new pizza oven, you know, which is great. So I'm being able to cook, you know, pizzas from scratch, you know, in a wood, it's wood and gas. So, you know, doing both things, but you can cook a nice bit of fish on a bit of wood in there. So it's, for me, it was just a practical thing. You know, my fiance is more vegetarian than I am. She would say that she eats a lot healthier than I. I would probably definitely agree. So it's just, you know, I can do interesting roasted vegetable things and stuff through that as well. So it's just, it's an extension of, you know, the house, indoor, you know, kitchen setup as well. So it's just nice, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Once one day when I grow up, I'll do something similar for sure.
I grow up.
Until then, I'm going to be on the road. I went to this, I've got a plethora of really nice, not all Michelin star, but some good Michelin star restaurant videos coming out for YouTube.
Oh, nice.
The one I just went to was Exted. It's only, there's no electricity or gas in the cooking. There's refrigeration.
Yeah.
But everything is done with wood and it's in Scandinavia. Oh, wow. So the heat is from birch and then any of the smoking they do is with juniper. So,
okay.
Oh, bro. Where do you see the video? Because the setup they have, it's brutal. They're all sweating back there, but they make it look good. And it was just, it was kind of like, you know how in Thai food, there's an essence of spice in everything. Like there's a tiny underlying layer of heat. I love heat anyway, big heat, but
yeah, same.
You know, it's a subtle thing there. And that's what every dish was like at this restaurant. There was just a subtle hint of smoke. And homeboy, Exted, the chef, like he had to relearn how to, these ancient recipes on how to actually cook stuff. And they did this cool thing where they'd flame smoked beef fat in this cool little, I think it was called a flambeau. It's like a Spanish thing, like almost like a cone with a handle. And they flame the fat onto an oyster that's on a wooden plank. And then they show you that. And then they kind of you know, tartered up and make it look sick. And it was like, oh, so it was awesome. It was mind blowing.
That sounds cool. Yeah, that sounds really cool. Yeah.
No,
the excitement in your face as you're telling that story is what I love about what we do, is when
someone has
a great experience and then they pass it on to someone else. You can just see the joy and that's what I love about what we do, for sure.
That's that shared passion. Like, you know, if you're going to hang out with a chef, you're going to have a good time.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great, great food, great chat. And just, I went out with Josh in San Diego and probably had one of the best.
Yes.
Like chefy, you know, nights that I've had in a very, very long time. It was just great, you know, just chatting shit, eating good food, drinking some good wine, good beers, local ales and stuff like that. Yeah, just having
so good, man.
Good old chat.
It's like educated hedonism. Like, we're gonna go eat some really hardcore shit. We're gonna drink some of the best, and then we're gonna swear and talk like sailors the whole time. And it's just this kind of like, oh, I love it, man. Chef dinners are the best. Yeah. One day you and I, either us or whoever's around, but man, that'd be 100%. Great. I really appreciate that.
Cheers to that, my friend. Cheers to that.
Cheers, homie. Well, let's call this a podcast. I really appreciate having you on, man. It's been good to kind of get to know you this way. And I'm happy to like, share your story with the community, because everyone's got a similar story, and I think it's a little bit not up to us, but I think some of the greenies in the industry and people wanting to get into it are going to want to hear the stories, you know, how they happen,
yeah,
how people 100%. Get in. Yeah,
awesome.
Cheers, brother. Well, thanks for coming on this episode of Get the Fork Out. Cheers, dude.
Pleasure. Cheers, man. Take it easy. We'll be right back.